But still it seemed necessary to hold the God's business of the highest importance. And Socrates, at least in his religious context, or Plato, if you wish, in his context, sets this up not just as something that Socrates decided to do for the heck of it, for kicks, but as a divine mission. I mean, Socrates suddenly felt impelled by the word of God, as it came through this oracle, to find out who was the wisest man. So he had this mission, and he spent the rest of his life, up until he landed in court, doing it. So I had to go on trying to find out what the oracle meant. And then he mentions that he went to all sorts of classes of people in the state. He went to the statesmen, as he mentioned. He went to the artists. He went to the craftsmen. All sorts of people, and kept questioning them and questioning them, and in effect showing up, pointing out to them, if they were willing to recognize it, the fact that they really didn't know very much, although they were all puffed up and thought they knew quite a bit. From this inquiry, gentlemen, many dislikes have arisen against me, and these and those are very dangerous and crushing. And out of this I got the title of being wise, for the bystanders always believe that I am wise myself in the matters on which I test another. But the truth really is, gentlemen, that the God, in fact, is wise. And in this oracle, he means to tell us that human wisdom is worth little or nothing. And it appears that he does not say this of Socrates, but simply adds my name to take me as an example. In other words, that the message here is really a universal message to all people and not just to Socrates. He does not say this of Socrates, but simply adds my name to take me as an example, as if he were to say that this one of you human beings is wisest, who, like Socrates, knows that he is worth nothing as regards wisdom. This is what I still, even now, go about searching and investigating in the God's way. If ever I think one of our people, or a foreigner, is wise, and whenever I don't find him so, I help the God by proving that the man is not wise. And because of this busy life, I have had no leisure either for public business worth mentioning or private, but I remain in poverty through my service to God. Besides this, the young men who have had the most leisure, sons of the most wealthy houses, if you wish, the hippies of our day, follow me of their own accord, delighted to hear people being cross-examined. And they often imitate me and try themselves to cross-examine. And then, I suspect, they find plenty of people who believe they know something when they know little or nothing. So in consequence, those who are cross-examined are angry with me instead of with themselves. And it seems to me this is a very worthwhile statement to reflect on. Those who are cross-examined are angry with me because he has set loose this swarm of cross-examiners on the city. They are angry with me instead of with themselves and say that Socrates is a blackguard and corrupts the young. And whenever someone asks, by doing what and by teaching what, they have nothing to say. They do not know, but unwilling to own that they are at a loss, they repeat the stock charges against all philosophers, underground lore and up-in-the-air lore, atheists making the weaker argument the stronger. For they would not like, I think, to say the truth, that they are shown up as pretending to know when they know nothing. So I think because they are ambitious and pushing and many in number, and they speak in battalions very plausibly about me, they have defeated you long since and now attack me vigorously. The result is, as I began by saying, that I should be surprised if I could erase this prejudice from you in so short a time when it has grown so great. In other words, he really, it seems at this point already in his defense, he assumes or is convinced that he will be convicted and that he will be put to death, and that the reason for his being put to death will be this prejudice, not any facts that can be brought against him, because as he goes on in cross-examining the prosecution, it comes out that this man really doesn't have a leg to stand on. But what really gets him in the end, so to speak, is this prejudice. And that seems to me a point worth noting. And he goes on to say then that this is the problem. Then he goes on to the prosecutor in this particular trial and says, next I will try to answer Meletus, the good patriot, as he calls himself. Once more then, let us take their affidavit as if they were another set of accusers. It says that Socrates is a criminal who corrupts the young and does not believe in the gods whom the state believes in, but other new spiritual things instead. Such is the accusation. Let us examine each point in this accusation. It says that I am a criminal who corrupts the young. And here, of course, this is still an issue in our day. What's going on in the colleges, anyway? It says that I am a criminal who corrupts the young. But I say, gentlemen, that Meletus is a criminal who is making a jest of serious things by prosecuting people lightly, by pretending to be serious, by pretending to care about things that he has never cared about at all. And I will try to show you. So then he gets Meletus to stand up, and Meletus initially says, that he is very concerned about the improvement of the youth. And Socrates then says, "Then tell these gentlemen who it is that makes them better. It is clear that you know, since you care about it. You have found the one who corrupts them, as you say, and you bring me before this court here and accuse me. Now then, say who makes them better. Inform the court who he is. You see, Meletus, you are silent. You cannot say. Yet does it not seem disgraceful to you, and a sufficient proof of what I am saying, that you have cared nothing about it? Come, my good man, say who makes them better. The laws. That's not what I ask, dear sir. What man, who in the first place knows this very thing, the laws? This jury, Socrates. What do you mean, Meletus? The gentlemen of the jury here are able to educate the young and make them better? Yes, indeed. All members of the jury, or only some of them? All of them. Excellently said, by Hera, quite an abundance of benefactors. Well, what of the people here listening to us? Do they make the young better or not? Yes, they do too. What about the counselors? That's the members of the legislature. The counselors too. Oh, indeed, Meletus, is it possible that the commons corrupt the younger generation, or do they also make them better? That's the lower house. They do. Then the whole nation of Athenians, it seems, makes them fine gentlemen except me, and I alone corrupt them. Is that what you say? That's exactly what I say. What bad luck for me. You charge me with my great bad luck. Answer me now. Are horses in the same case, do you think? All the men in the world are making them better and only one corrupting them? Isn't the truth quite the opposite here? There is one, perhaps, able to make them better, or very few, the horse trainers, so-called. But most people, if they have to do with horses and use them, spoil and corrupt them. Isn't that the case, Meletus? Both with horses and with all other animals? Most certainly it is, whether you or Anytus say no or whether you say yes. What a blessing it would be for young people if only a single one corrupts them and all the rest do them good. But really, this example is enough to show that you were never serious about young people. You are clearly showing your own carelessness. And then he goes on to ask another question. Is it better to live among good citizens or bad ones? Do the bad ones do some harm to those who are at any time nearest to them, and the good ones good? Surely, he says. Then is there anyone who wants to be damaged by his associates rather than helped? No. Very well, you bring me here as one who corrupts the young generation and makes them worse. Do you say that I mean to do it, or that it's only accidental? You mean to do it. Oh, dear me, Meletus. I am so old and you so young, and yet you are so much wiser than I am. You know that bad men always do harm to those who are nearest them, but good men do good. Yet look at me. Have I come to such a depth of ignorance that I don't know this, that if I make one of my associates bad, I shall risk getting some evil from him, and that I am doing this intentionally? In other words, he goes on to, in this way, attack the various arguments that a man would be a fool to go around corrupting his associates because the only thing he could expect from them would be corruption. And he feels in this way, and as he goes on and on with the cross-examination, that he's able to demolish Meletus. Now, at this point, then, he also discusses the religious charge, which I think we can pass over at this point, because the dialogue does get a little long. Now, he goes back, then, to this prejudice thing that we mentioned earlier. And says, this is what will convict me if anything does, not Meletus, whom he has pretty thoroughly demolished, but prejudice and dislike by so many people. The same thing has convicted many other good men, and I think will do so again. There is no fear it will stop with me. But perhaps someone will say, aren't you ashamed then, Socrates, that having followed such a practice that you now run a risk of sentence of death? Or perhaps in our day they'd say, aren't you ashamed that you got tossed in jail? I would answer such a one fairly. You are wrong, my friend, if you think a man with a spark of decency in him ought to calculate life or death. The only thing he ought to consider, if he does anything, is whether he does right or wrong, whether it is what a good man does or a bad man. For according to your argument, and then he goes into a little Greek history here, or Greek mythology. For according to your argument, in the Trojan War, those of the heroes who died would have been poor creatures, particularly Achilles. He so despised danger in comparison with undergoing disgrace that when he wished to kill Hector, and his mother, a goddess herself, said to him, "My son, if you avenge the slaughter of your friend Patroclus and kill Hector, you will be killed yourself." When he heard this, he belittled danger and death and much rather feared to live as a coward who would not avenge his friends, and replied, "Right after this, let me die when I have punished the offender. I don't want to stay here a laughingstock beside the ships, a burden to the earth." You cannot think that he cared about danger and death. And this is true, gentlemen. Whenever a man places himself, wherever a man places himself, believing it to be the best place, or wherever he has been placed by his captain, there he must stay, as I think, and run any risk there is, calculating neither death nor anything before disgrace. And then he goes on to tell how he had acted when he was in the military and how he had stood his ground and had nearly been killed at that point. I mean, again, this part of his defense in the trial. And how later on he had, in political life a couple of times, gone against what the authorities had wanted and risked being killed, because there was a real battle going on in his day between a group of aristocrats who wanted to take over the state and a group of so-called Democrats who wanted to continue, if you wish, the Athenian democracy. And he goes on to say that if they put him to death, they are really hurting themselves more. That the state is going to be at a loss, the state of Athens, the city-state, is going to be really at a loss to replace a man like Socrates, and that his role is a very crucial one. And here comes this metaphor then that has sort of permeates our culture, but which many people don't really stop and think about, perhaps. This thing about the gadfly. He talks about the state, and he says he had been stuck on the state by the god, though it is rather laughable to say so. For the state is like a big thoroughbred horse. I tend to think of some of these big workhorses, Belgian horses or something. So big that he is a bit slow and heavy and wants a gadfly to wake him up. I think that the god put me on the state something like that, to wake you up and persuade you and reproach every one of you as I keep settling on you everywhere all day long. Such another will not easily be found by you, gentlemen, and if you will be persuaded, you will spare me. You will be vexed, perhaps, like sleepers being awaked. And if you listen to Anytus and give me a tap, you can easily kill me. Then you can go on sleeping for the rest of your lives, unless God sends you another such in his care for you. That I am really the one given to you by God, you can easily see from this. For it does not seem human that I have neglected all my own interests, that I have been content with the neglect of my domestic affairs all these years, while always I was attending to your interests, approaching each of you privately like a father or elder brother, and persuading you to care for virtue. And indeed, if I had gained any advantage from this and taken fees for my advice, there would have been some reason in it. But as it is, you see yourselves that my accusers, although accusing me so shamelessly of everything else, did not have the effrontery or ability to produce a single witness to testify that I ever asked for a fee. And I produce, I think, the sufficient witness that I speak the truth, namely my poverty. Perhaps it may seem odd that although I go about and give all this advice privately, like a busybody, yet I dare not appear before your public assembly and advise the state. And then he goes on to say that if he got into public life, he would have been killed a lot sooner than if he had stayed a private citizen, going quietly around trying to convince the people of what virtue was and the fact that true wisdom consists, or at least the beginning of wisdom, if you wish, is the understanding that you really don't know anything at all. But why do some people enjoy spending a great deal of time with me? You have heard why, gentlemen. I have told you the whole truth. They enjoy hearing men cross-examined who think they are wise and are not. And indeed, that is not unpleasant. And I maintain that I have been commanded by the god to do this, through oracles and dreams, and in every way in which some divine influence or other has ever commanded a man to do anything. And he goes on and points to a whole series of boys in the court who stand up and testify, in effect, or at least nod their heads as the transcript goes on here, to the fact that he has done nothing but encourage them to be virtuous. Now what happens is that the defense eventually comes to an end, and the court votes and finds him guilty of the charge, the vote being 281 guilt for guilty and 220 for innocence. Now in the Greek system then, the indicted man had the opportunity of proposing a penalty. The accuser proposed a penalty, any defendant proposed a penalty, and then the court would vote again on which of the penalties they preferred to have. And at this point, Socrates' irony comes out very clear again. He begins by saying that he's very surprised that the verdict was so close, that if 30 votes had been changed, he would have been acquitted out of this total assembly of close to, well, around 600 people. Now, Anet or Miletus then had demanded the death penalty for Socrates. And he goes on to say, "What penalty should I propose? The proper penalty is surely clear, but what is it? What is proper for me to suffer or to pay for not having the sense to be idle in my life and for neglecting what most people care about, money-making, housekeeping, military appointments, oratory, and besides all the posts, plots, parties which arise in this city? For believing myself to be really too honest to go after these things and survive, I did not go where I thought I should be of no use, either to you or myself, but I went where I hoped I might benefit each man separately with the greatest possible benefit. I tried to persuade each of you to take care for himself first, namely in how he could become the most good and most wise before he took care for any of his interests, like the money-making and so on. And to take care for the state first before he took care of any of her interests. Then what do I deserve, since I am such as that? Something good, gentlemen, if I am to make the estimate what it ought to be in truth, and further something good which would be suitable for me. Then what is suitable for a poor benefactor who craves to have leisure for your encouragement? Nothing, gentlemen, is so suitable as that such a man should be boarded free in the town hall, which he deserves much more than any one of you who has gained the prize at Olympia, at the Olympic Games, with a pair of horses or a four in hand." And these people, apparently, because of their Olympic victories, did receive a type of guaranteed annual income from the city-state of Athens. They were taking care of these athletes. And he says he feels that he is entitled to it much more than they. "Thus, if I must estimate the just penalty according to my deserts, this is my estimate, free board in the town hall. Perhaps you think in saying this I'm just showing off, but I cannot conceive that I have wronged anyone. And being convinced that I have wronged no man, I will not wrong myself. I will not give sentence against myself and say that I am worthy of something bad. I will not estimate anything bad for myself, for why should I? For fear of suffering what Miletus demands, when I say I do not know whether it is good or bad. Instead of that, shall I choose one of the things which I know are bad and propose that as a penalty? Prison, a fine, exile." And then he goes on to say how exile would be stupid for him to propose, because as soon as he was exiled, he, being 70 years old and fixed in his ways, would continue to do the same type of thing. He'd go around questioning people and bugging him again like a gadfly. The people in the next city would kick him out or kill him, so exile would be a stupid proposal. Perhaps some might say, "Can't you go away from us, Socrates, and shut up and lead a quiet life?" Now here's the most difficult thing of all to make some of you believe or do understand. For if I say that this is to disobey the god, and therefore I cannot keep quiet, you will not believe me, but think I am a humbug. If again I say it is the greatest good for a man every day to discuss virtue, and the other things about which you hear me talking and examining myself and everybody else, and that the life without inquiry, or as it used to be translated, the unexamined life, is not worth living for a man, you will believe me still less. And yet all this is true, as I tell you, but to convince you is not easy. At the same time, I have never been accustomed to think that I deserve anything bad. If I had money, I would have proposed to pay all I was bound to pay as a fine, for I should have had no harm by that. But as it is, I have none. So then at that point, some of his disciples come up and say that they would pay any fine whatsoever. Some of his friends happen to be fairly wealthy. So the court votes again and condemns him to death. And then Socrates apparently is allowed a final word. "You would not have had long to wait, gentlemen, but that short time will have given you the name and the blame of killing Socrates, a wise man. So those will say who wish to speak evil of our city, for they will certainly call me wise, even if I am not, when they wish to taunt you. If you had only waited a short time, this would have come to you of itself. Look at my age. This I say not to you all, but to those who voted for my death, and I have something else to say to those men. Perhaps you think, gentlemen, that it was lack of words which defeated me, such words as might have persuaded you. If I had thought it right to do and say anything," and he had earlier in a passage I omitted told him why he would not grovel before the court and weep and bring in his children and say, are you going to make these poor fatherless orphans and so on? And that I would not do everything to be acquitted. Far from it. But it was a lack which defeated me. Not a lack of words, but a lack of effrontery and shamelessness. A lack of willingness to make you the sort of address which you would like best to hear. To hear me wailing and weeping, or saying and doing many things unworthy of me, such as you are accustomed to hear from others. But then I did not think that I ought to do anything servile because of my danger. And now I do not regret that such was the manner of my defense. I much prefer to die after such a defense than to live by the other type of defense. Neither in court nor in war ought I or anyone else to do anything or everything to contrive an escape from death. In battle, it is often clear that a man might escape by throwing down his arms and begging mercy from his pursuers. And there are many other means in every danger for escaping death if a man can bring himself to do and say anything and everything. No, gentlemen, the difficult thing is not to escape death, I think, but to escape wickedness. That is much more difficult, for wickedness runs much faster than death. And now I, being slow and old, have been caught by the slower one, namely death. But my accusers, being clever and quick, have been caught by the swifter. And now I and they depart, I condemned by you to death, but these condemned by truth to depravity and injustice. I abide by my penalty, they by theirs. Perhaps this was to be so, and I think it is fair enough. But as to the future, I wish to chant this prophecy to you whose votes have condemned me. For now I am in the place where men chiefly prophesy, namely in the sight of coming death. I foretell you, gentlemen, my slayers, that a punishment will come upon you right after my death, much harder than than execution at your hands is to me. More than one of those who demand from you that account, those whom I have restrained now, although you did not perceive it, and they will be harder upon you, inasmuch as they are younger, and you will resent it more. I must interpolate here for a moment. I can't help but hear in this, as we read Socrates, perhaps into our own context, the voice of, say, some sort of black moderate who has, if not physically, perhaps either politically or psychologically, been wiped out. And what he is saying is that this was really a blunder, because now you have had it. Your reputation is gone, and perhaps even your very safety is gone. For if you believe that by putting men to death you will stop everyone from reproaching you because your life is wrong, you make a great mistake. But with those who voted to acquit me, I would gladly converse about this event which has taken place here, what's going on here, while the magistrates are busy, and I have not yet gone into the cell. And then apparently the people who had voted for his acquittal take off, his indictment take off, and the people who voted in his favor stay. And he talks to them about, as he puts it, the real meaning of what happened here. What happened, he says, is a wonderful thing that he goes on to say. He had this inner voice which used to restrain him when he was about to do something, make a mistake, do something wrong. And that throughout the whole trial, this inner, whatever you want to call it, apprehension or whatnot, had not spoken. Now he says, let us consider how great is the hope that it is good. Namely, what has happened here is really good. Death is one of two things. Either the dead man is nothing and has no consciousness of anything, or it is, as people say, a change and a migration from this place to another place. If there is no consciousness, and it is like sleep, when one sleeping sees nothing, not even a dream, death would be a wonderful blessing. For I think that if a man should select that night in which he slumbered so deep that he did not even dream, and he should put beside that night all other nights and days of his life, and were to say, after considering how many sweeter days and nights than that night he had spent in his whole life, I think that anyone would say that that was the best night of his life. If then death is like that, I call it a blessing. For so eternity seems no more than one night. But if again death is migration from this world into another place, and if what they say is true, that there all the dead are, what greater good could be than this? For if one comes to the house of Hades, now not hell in the Christian sense, but just an abode of disembodied souls, if one comes to Hades rid of those who dub themselves judges, and find those who truly are judges, the same who are said to sit in judgment there, would that migration be a poor thing? On the contrary, to be in company with Orpheus and Musaios and Hesiod and Homer, how much would one of you give for that? For myself, I am willing to die many times if this is true, since I myself should find staying there a wonderful thing. Then I could meet, and he rattles off a whole list of names from the golden age of Greece. I could meet all these people and any other of the ancients who died by an unjust judgment and compare my experience with theirs. And this, I think, would be quite agreeable. And best of all, to go on cross-examining the people there, as I did here, and investigating which of them is wise and which thinks he is but is not. How much would one give to cross-examine him who led the great invasion against Troy, or Odysseus, or Sisyphus, or thousands of other men and women? To converse with them and to be with them and to cross-examine them would be an infinity of happiness. There, at all events, I don't suppose they put anyone to death for that, for in that world they are happier than we here, particularly because already, for the rest of time, they are immortal, if what people say is true. But you also, judges of the court, must have good hopes towards death, and this one thing you must take as true. No evil can happen to a good man, either living or dead. That is why my signal did not warn me off, and why I am not angry with those who condemn me or with my accusers. And then he goes on to say that they should treat his sons as he had been treating the city, that they should reproach them, should ask them what they're doing, why they're doing it, how they're doing it, if there's any virtue in it, and so on and so forth. And then we end up with this very, if you wish, agnostic statement or faith statement, depending on how you look at it. Now it is time to go, I to die and you to live. But which of us goes to a better thing is unknown to all but God. And at that point the dialogue ends. Now there is another dialogue that comes later entitled the Phaedo. Well, there are two, actually, which occur, one called the Crito and one called the Phaedo, which deal with the events of Socrates in prison before he actually drank the poison, the hemlock. And the Phaedo, of course, I shouldn't say of course, perhaps, but the Phaedo is cast by Plato in the last day of Socrates' life, the day in which, at even, at sundown, he would have to drink the poison. And he spends the whole day very calmly discussing the immortality of the soul, the arguments pro and con. And his disciples are becoming increasingly hysterical. And he's calmly sitting there going on, both comforting them and discussing the prospects and really taking a rather agnostic stand, sort of like he did here, namely, we don't know what's going to happen beyond the grave, so why sweat it? Why should we have any fear of the unknown type of thing? Even if we do, we ought to try and exorcise it. And as some have pointed out, including biblical scholars like Christer Stendahl, the dean of Harvard Divinity School, the contrast between the picture you get of Socrates on the day of his death and the picture you get of Christ on the day, or if you wish, a couple of days preceding his death, is quite striking. Now, I don't wish to go off into that, but too much, except that here we have the report of one person in our culture who seemed to be convicted for, if I may borrow a phrase, telling it like it is, for pointing out to people the facts about themselves. And of course, the phrase that has endured from this dialogue down through 2,500 years is, the unexamined life is not a life worth living for a man. It might be okay for a dog or a nasturtium or a mountain, but not for a man. That we have this self-awareness, and it's our obligation as people to examine our lives, to come to know ourselves, no matter how painful this might be. And of course, as Socrates points out, it's difficult, perhaps, for a person to examine himself. He was pushed into it by the deity. He didn't just go off and do it himself. He got this divine mission, and then he did it to other people. And with the upshot that they got very mad at him. And I think that perhaps the overriding conclusion coming out of this is that people really don't want to know about themselves. And if anybody tries to really tell them about themselves, the ultimate conclusion of it is they'll get wiped out. But as I say, this takes the place of what of the neat classroom lecture I had intended to deliver under the title Knowledge is Power. So if you want to discuss it or just sit and mull it over, it's fine.
Isn't this the same thing that the teenagers are saying today?
Sorry?
Isn't this the same thing? The first, kid must find out who he is before he's, as his voice said last night, he had to be a person. Do you know who he was? Is the same thing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in other words, what if you read between the lines, what seems to be said here is that what is uniquely human is self-awareness, but that this isn't automatic. I mean, it's not just given to you. You have to go out and work for it. You know, right. But again, well, if I could just add, I've read enough, I'm afraid, but another moral to the tale, if you wish, seems to be that this is a constant process. I mean, it's not just for the youth, because Socrates never talked once about going out and cross-examining a young person, you'll notice. He always talked about going to what today we would call the establishment, the statesman, the craftsman who had made it, and who had a reputation for knowing what beauty was all about. You know, they produced beautiful articles and people bought them and so on. And he'd go and ask them, or poets who already had an established reputation for good poetry. And he'd go and ask them, you know, what are you doing and how do you do it? What is it that makes a good poem? Maybe Socrates was too analytical, but at any rate, these people were hard-pressed to come up with answers. And instead of letting that worry them, they just got mad at Socrates for having asked them.
When you were reading this, Dave, I couldn't help but think of the parable of the vineyard where the guy sends his beloved son and they kill him. And it always puzzled me for a long time. And it says after that, because you have killed the beloved son, God will destroy you, or you will be destroyed. And I really, you know, it seemed kind of harsh at first, but that's really true. If you kill the person that asks the crucial question, you are, in a sense, destroyed. If you kill the, maybe not physically. But
yeah, that's an interesting parallel.
And that you really don't have that check, you are judged at that point, you are condemned at that point. You condemn yourself. But
I suppose one hang up we would have in this quote scientific unquote age, which for the purpose of what I'm saying could be at least defined as a reliance on evidence, is the whole question of how we tell who this is. You know, as the old platitude that if Christ were to come today, we'd lock him up in an insane asylum or something, because, you know, what would you say if somebody bounced in here and said, I'm the Son of God, follow me? I mean, would you drop all and do it? Or would you say, you know, get this guy to the shrink so that we can find out what's wrong with him? And I suppose, I mean, that's one problem, it seems to me, the people of Athens had, that the very ones whom Socrates was cross-examining day in and day out as he met them in the marketplace were those who seemed to be the ones, you know, that you ought to align yourself with. You know, and if you went against them, then you were destroyed. And whereas, at least as Socrates saw it, it was just the other way around. I was really struck, both literally and figuratively, by the darkness that can be created in the middle of the day in a village center. Because a couple of weeks ago, well, you just left this week, we had a geologist here, Larry Collins, who showed a whole series of slides. And if you would come in the middle of that show out of this bright mountain sun, it would take you minutes for your eyes to adjust. And it was really funny because the people who had been in there from the beginning and whose eyes had adjusted to this situation and who were quite comfortable really ended up at certain points laughing at the others who came in, because the ones who had just come in couldn't tell whether there was a bench there or a chair there. I know a couple of times I was sitting in a bench and people literally stumbled right over me. I was nasty enough just to sit there and see what they'd do. They just, you know, they couldn't even see that there was a person there or anything. And they just walked on, and it took a certain time for this natural adjustment to occur. And this seemed to me perhaps a parable for our situation, as Duane put it last night in terms of Pablo or something. I mean, people look at the same thing from different perspectives. One man's just come out of the sun, another man's been sitting in the dark for 5 minutes, and the things look altogether different. And one man can see things that the other man can't. And this may be, I mean, this obviously is, not just maybe our difficulty, but...
At the same time, though, you can carry that analogy a bit further and say, this person, had he come in and say, I'm trying to adjust and looking at a flashlight, would never be able to overcome that flashlight and see it up.
If you want to go even further, you could even turn the lights on, though, people who had already adjusted would be on.
That's what's called mental gymnastics.
But I mean, I think that there are some instances in which all of us struggle not to have to change, because we recognize that each change involves some pain somewhere along the line. It either means giving up something that we've had before, or which we have to grieve over a loss, or
Do you really think in your fantasy that Socrates was without pain when he was doing this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the analogy I mentioned between, or dichotomy between Christ and Socrates breaks down in terms of the method of their execution. I mean, Christ went through an extremely painful, a physically painful thing, whereas as Socrates probably did not in the same sense. I mean, what he did was drink a certain poison and then was instructed to walk around until his legs felt heavy and then to lie down. And that obviously is quite different from being crucified. But
I meant painful more in this confrontation, say, you know, these people that accused him. I mean, it's hard for me to fantasize a guy that's so whole that, you know, that when people say, I'm going to put you to death, you just sit there and really accept that without pain. I mean, obviously he worked it out. He had it all worked out sort of in his head.
Yeah. I don't know. There are a lot of variables in here, of course. One is that he was 70 years old at the time, and as he mentions, after they had condemned him to death, you know, he only had at most a few more years to live anyway. And at death, I mean, as I recall my grandparents and so on, death really was not a terrifying specter so much when they got older. I mean, in fact, for a couple of my grandparents, it was something that, it was actually a release, something that they longed for a period of a couple of years. So I really don't know. I mean, we have, for example, in our own situation within the past, say, 5-6 years, the example of self-immolation, say, of Buddhist monks or something like that. I mean, it's conceivable to me, at least, that there could be that type of person, whether, even though I'm not.
For instance, I imagine, you know, in our experience, say, last night, that was Willie here, that, you know, I was feeling like he was feeling pain, you know, having to confront us with this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether he was or not, but I imagine, you know, I should ask him.
Well, I suppose one motivation I have, and my motives are obviously mixed in this, but one motivation is sort of the idea, you know, that there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, here was Socrates 2,500 years ago going through much the same thing that perhaps the black man, either generically or individually, is going through today. And I mean, Socrates is quite explicit over and over and over again in the early parts of the thing, saying that what's going to get him is prejudice, you know, that... And he goes on to show this, or at least Plato in writing it goes on to show that the actual prosecution and the prosecution witnesses could be very easily demolished, and they didn't have a leg to stand on. But nevertheless, he was convicted anyway. And I mean, I suspect that many members of the jury were people whom Socrates had buttonholed in the marketplace, you know, and made to look fools. And this was one way they could vindicate themselves. Well, the coffee break bell has rung, so.